Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, and I am one half of the Legal Geeks. With me tonight for a special podcast is Dr. Andrea Litamende from the Arkham Sessions podcast and Lattes with Leia. She is all around awesome. I know her from the Geeky Awards, and she helped us with our mock trial of the Winter Soldier. Andrea, how are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you for having me on your show, Josh.
We've been in orbit. It's nice to actually interact. It was so much fun working with you at San Diego Comic Fest, and now we get to talk about Batman.
Yes, my favorite topic.
Let's talk about Bat-Jim.
Yes, let's talk about Bat-Jim.
He's the dad that not only that we deserve, but the one that we need. So from issue 41 to 49, I think has been fantastic. I love what Scott Schneider's done. What are your thoughts on it?
I just want to jump off what you said about Scott, the writer of Batman. He is, I think, by far one of the best writers when it comes to really capturing and expressing the deeper psychology of Batman and the various characters. Of course, the Joker, of course, the Riddler, the Commissioner, all of the characters that we've grown to love and understand, but now I think we have such a richer, deeper, and a more troubling understanding of these characters. And although I struggled with a new Batman, of course, Jim Gordon being Batman and what that means, which I'm sure we'll talk about, I struggled with that transition, but the depth and just the tragedy around it is so fascinating. So I cannot say enough about the level of this writing. It is incredible.
I agree with everything that you've said. And I was actually excited for Gordon to take up the cowl.
Really?
I actually wasn't reading Batman. I go on and off sometimes. You know, when the New 52 started, I took a sabbatical from DC because I was a little upset with that. But Bat-Jim and the way that, you know, thinking as an attorney, the struggle that Gordon went through and his arc in deciding, yes, I will do it, highlighting he's, 46, looking at the young rookies who are potentially going to take up the cowl and going, look, that one has a kid, and deciding to do it himself. I thought, like, okay, this is fascinating.
I think that he has also a deeper understanding of what it means to be Batman, that I think he looked at those younger rookies and thought they don't quite have the knowledge of the adversity and the history of trauma that it actually takes to really wear the cape and cowl. And there's something incredibly gritty and dark and certainly troubling about being Batman. And only Jim Gordon understands that. So I think it was this sense of him being a martyr, of him being almost a risk taker around this, that I think there's an element of wanting to serve the city. There's an element that's very Jim Gordon, right? It's my duty. I must serve and protect. I have to take the place. But at the same time, there's this sense of, I don't know, risk taking or sensation seeking, something around knowing just how dangerous and lethal this role is. And believing that he should experience that. Does that make sense? Like, there's this sense of like, I know this might kill me, and I'm interested in it.
I agree. I thought back in issue 41, the rooftop discussion with Bullock was very enlightening to get into the psychology, because he questioned, what if Batman had worked within the system? What impact would that have had? And it was kind of a wish that he wanted the original Batman to have. Mm-hmm. And he had the opportunity to take it up himself. And also, I think it highlights why people go into law enforcement, because they want to serve and protect. They want to keep the streets safe. They want to protect others. That's why people become police officers, where your days are spent wearing a bulletproof vest, combat boots, and getting shot at and seeing the worst of humanity.
And it takes an element of risk-taking, that you have to meet that level personality-wise. You have to meet that level of being willing. I mean, this is true of service, military service, right? You have to be willing to put yourself in the line of fire and understand the mission is beyond a single person, and at the same time, feel the sense of bravery and courage and bravado that it takes to do that. And I don't mean at all to sound negative about this, other than there has to be an element of risk-taking or this willingness to be in a threatening environment. And not all of us, I mean, I say this as someone who's not willing to be in a threatening environment. This is why I went into psychology. I'd prefer to handle the aftermath. I think that some of us are just built for being in threatening environments, and other folks are simply not.
So my mother was a paramedic when I was very young, and so she wore combat boots. She put on 24-hour shifts. So my childhood, I got to see that personality type with my mother and the firemen she worked with and the police officers that she worked with. So I completely understand what you're describing because I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredibly brave, and it's very self-sacrificing. And I think various professions, I mean, you probably encounter it in your profession, we're all experiencing some element of these phases. And some folks will tell me, I don't know how you do it. I wouldn't be able to handle the aftermath. I don't know how you face that and interpret that and process that over and over again. And I think that that's just a different type of person. But it really comes down to resiliency, right? That we're talking about psychological resiliency.
Agreed. Which is, I think, captured very nicely with Jim Gordon in representing the best of what law enforcement is, of what a public servant is, and knowing how bad things are in the narrows and willing to go into the fight. For those who haven't read it, go to your comic book store now, start at 41, and buy up to 49, and 50 should be out in a week or two, if I got the count right, because there's some great stuff in there. Not diving too much into the past, Batman is dead, and somehow Bruce Wayne's resurrected, and he's resurrected without his memories. And after that happens, we find out Bruce is alive, Gordon's become the Batman in a nice battle armor. At Comic Fest, I heard you talk about how the trauma to Bruce Wayne is important for him being Batman. And in this comic, we get to see him without trauma on how he would be. Did that meet your expectations in your professional opinion?
It's such an interesting journey as far as Bruce Wayne's storyline in this arc, like you said, 41 through 49, because in the beginning, he's a little bit of a shell of a person. He doesn't, like you said, he doesn't have those memories. What we know is that he's been in this tragic accident and has no recollection of being Batman or being Bruce Wayne. He's starting anew. And on his end, his interpretation is almost this sense of peacefulness about it, this sense of, well, I don't know, I didn't know what it was like to be this billionaire and have access to all of these technological advancements and scientific innovations. And he, throughout his journey, is starting to realize through other people's suggestions and through some strange flashbacks and things that are happening to him that he's the Batman. And I think that his identity, I mean, if we talk about this fragile identity that he is, he's just incredibly one-dimensional in a way that he didn't have knowledge of his history, but then is okay with that, is building a relationship, is, you know, again, just sort of at peace. And what I found fascinating about that, and we'll go into what happens to him, but what I feel is very fascinating about his status as the, you know, the Bruce Wayne without the memories, is that he had some of his closest allies be pretty content with that. Jim Gordon and then Alfred expressing that they're just fine with it. In fact, Alfred appears to be almost relieved that the Batman is dead and that now Bruce Wayne can be Bruce Wayne, whoever that is. So it's this interesting discovery that all this time there was this man, this Bruce Wayne identity that was hidden there and is now living and breathing and exploring his identity. And I had trouble with that. I don't know if I felt that something was missing. I don't know if I felt that he needed to find his true calling. You know, who is he? So I think your question is really incredibly important. Like, without that history of trauma and adversity, and I'm not just talking about the death of his parents, the murder of his parents, but it makes it very clear that there are repetitive chronic exposures to trauma coming from combat, coming from death and loss, coming from adversity, just being the Bat. Like, it makes that this arc makes it very clear that being the Batman means you're exposed brutally to some incredible threats and that your life is marked by this. You are your identity, your whole being is this tragic chaos and high level threat throughout your life. And I think that that was just an interesting thing for me to come to grips with. And I agreed with it. I felt like that is a pretty accurate conceptualization of who Batman is. And if you take all that away, who's left? Is the person left a person? Who is that? And how do we feel about that person?
It is an interesting case study because he's working at a community center. And when I looked at him, being a history geek, I thought of some of the philanthropists from the late 19th, early 20th century who inherited fortunes and just went around doing good deeds. Looking at Bruce Wayne, the clean slate, he's just a really nice guy who's engaged in the community.
Right.
And I thought that made sense to me on how someone with fortune who was good would be.
And it could be. And I mean, I think that could be revealing that a core personality trait of his could be that professional caregiver, that all in all, he's about giving to community and that he does want to protect and to ensure that the disadvantaged folks have something better, have something, you know, something to look forward to. I still believe, at least in the way that he's portrayed, that there seems to be something missing. It's a strange, you know, like they show him in his relationship with Julie
Madison.
And he's expressed interest in marrying her. And there are these scenes with them together. They're very romantic. And I don't know if it's just reading Batman for years and years, you just become very, I don't know, suspicious of this. Like, how can he possibly be in a relationship? This is troubling to me. I'm uncomfortable, you know, like all these things that most of us, I think this is intended. I think we're supposed to feel a little bit weird about this, like Twilight Zone, weird, creepy, and it's such an interesting concept, right? Like Bruce Wayne is happy and we're creeped out by it. We don't like it.
It's funny you had that reaction because I was okay with it. And you know, thinking back to after Final Crisis, when the world thinks he's dead the first time and Grayson takes up the cowl, I thought that was a great arc. I love Dick Grayson as Batman and what it meant for him to be Batman, which was part of my comfort level with Jim Gordon being Batman, which to jump to Marvel, why I was very comfortable with Bucky being Captain America after Steve died, and the Falcon being the current Captain America. I was comfortable with those changes.
You know, I think for me, and I can see that, I think for me it was the way in which it happened, that it was out of his control. It is the definition of a trauma, something out of your control, something that makes you feel you might lose your life, something that threatens you, almost dying. It's at the end of Endgame where the Joker and Batman are battling it out, and they both essentially collapse. They're crushed, you know. So the idea is that they both die at the end of that arc. I think that for me, the reason I'm troubled by this Bruce Wayne in his experience of what I would call compassion satisfaction is that it came about after this serious traumatic experience, that it was the aftermath of loss of control and threat, and that he had nothing to do with it. You know, like if he had something to do with his level of satisfaction and high quality of life and all that, this would feel better, but this does not feel good to me.
That is a thoughtful perspective. And I didn't read Endgame, so I came in after that. So maybe that's part of the reason why I had a comfort level with it. And I'll pick it up in trade and see if that changes my reaction. But I have read Batman for the last 30 years on and off. So I do have a strong comfort level with him for what he does, what he represents. And it's part of the reason why I like seeing Gordon take up the cowl, because he also has that understanding.
Right.
What do you make of Bruce Wayne working at this community center in the Narrows?
I think you're right that this is an authentic expression of what his wishes and desires are and what his core personality features are. Again, I sort of feel like there's something missing, that he's still hollow in a few ways, but we do see him connect with the kids. We do see him in this really, really lovely kind of meaningful way take what was the destruction, and I believe what was the site in which he, well, I don't know that he knows this, but the site in which the Batman died, and he re-envisions this area and creates this playground for the kids. And you can see that he has heart and that he wants to provide to the community and that he's very content. There's this sense of actual contentment. And I think that's truly nice about this portrayal of him. And I think that it's fitting that he's working at this community center. And what I can't help but speak to what other characters are pointing out to him. The kiddo that is essentially Robin is telling him that he's not seeing what's in front of him, that all this time he's still a detective. He's still figuring things out that other people can't figure out. He has this high level of intelligence and truth-seeking and fact-finding, and no one else is like this. So there's this, you know, other people can sense that he's the Batman, and he's being almost accused of ignoring this calling. And it's just one perspective, but I think that it's valuable in understanding what does that mean for this person who has no memories of this, first of all, but secondly, who's experiencing other people say, you have a higher calling and your value is being missed. Like you are needing to fulfill this really important role.
Agreed. I thought that was very well written. I also liked seeing Alfred's counter arc throughout that, with Alfred wanting to, like, no, you're my son, because he did raise him, and Alfred wants Bruce to be happy and wants Bruce to ride off into the sunset and have a good life, and thinking, it's Jim Gordon's turn. Others can deal with this.
And that, I mean, that conversation, that's in, four, is that in 49?
Part of 49, also when Alfred was, I believe, talking to Superman around, might have been 43 or 44.
Oh, earlier on, right. Yeah. That was heartbreaking. I mean, I have to admit, I was tearful because what Alfred was saying was true, that I mean, just from Alfred's perspective, and what he was saying is he was trying to, you know, he was seeing these little glimmers of Bruce Wayne, the true Bruce Wayne, this joyful boy that he knew, and that he would, yes, he would patch up Batman and he would be there and he would attend to him and essentially be a part of the Bat family. But it sounds as though he was representing connection to humanity, connection to family, and understanding that the real person who he truly loves is not Batman, is not even what Batman's representing, but Bruce Wayne, this person who miraculously has been relieved of that outer shell. I mean, there's so much symbolism here, right? With the actual Batman armor being this like shell mechanic figure that can be functional on its own in this arc. And so I think, I mean, that's such an interesting concept. They even create this bat army of just a bunch of various bat armored mechanical, I believe, pretty much remote controlled figures who would act sort of as the police department and enforce the law. So I think that there's this element of like, you know, Batman is representing or can represent that force, and you don't need a single person anymore to do that.
It is, I hadn't thought of it as the shell, and that was neat. So well done.
I'm a psychologist. I can't help myself.
I look at it from the legal issues, so this is why it's nice to talk to another professional, because like, oh, I was looking at it from the Miranda point of view. And
well, what for you as a lawyer, what comes up for you as far as what they're trying to create with this bat army and how they're visualizing this protective force? What were your thoughts about that?
There is an administration of justice issue when you have a city plagued with supervillains, so the normal police force can't handle it. And leveraging technology to go, we're going to give everybody the Bat app, it's a free download, and then analyzing big data when reports are coming in of bad things happening, and being able to deploy the Batman to go save the day, who can then realize, okay, he doesn't actually effectuate the arrests. They have other police officers do that, which then takes care of testifying at trial, because they're tried to keep Gordon's identity a secret, so that way his family wouldn't be targeted. He was living at his bat cave with his bat semi. It's a fascinating look at the police adopting some elements of vigilanteism, but not turning into vigilantes themselves, because they still want due process to take place. They want people to be arrested properly, tried and convicted, to keep the community safe.
So how then do you feel, it sounds like you've been reading Batman for a long time, how do you feel about the, the traditional order where Batman has sometimes collaborated, and I use that word very loosely, with the GCPD, but for the most part acts alone and takes initiative to kind of recreate law in order to basically uphold the law. I mean, there's this weird dynamic where as a vigilante, he's going a little bit further than what the police department would do, but ultimately it's better for the community. Or, I mean, that could be based on opinion, but what are your thoughts about that sort of traditional order?
Complex. Because as a lawyer, I should say, I don't believe in vigilanteism. You know, we're going to get the right. Daredevil this week, and I think the Punisher is a terrifying character who goes around assassinating those who conduct crime. Skips judge, jury, goes straight to executioner, and like, I have a problem with that. Batman doesn't kill, and Batman gets them arrested. So that's good. And we're in a fictional world where crime is so bad, and you have, you know, supervillains that are crocodiles and fear gas and all this horrible stuff, that you need someone who's a step outside the system to combat it, because it's beyond the scope and scale of what the police can handle. So there are times when Batman's deputized, times when he's not. And then you need to look at, is his actions falling under what would be rescuing others? Because you have no affirmative duty to go out and rescue people, but you can. So if you see people getting kidnapped, you can stop
right.
it.
If I see a building on fire, I can run in and save people.
Exactly. Now, conducting law enforcement, he's like really, really getting into some problems here because we don't want people doing that. But in the fictional world of Gotham, where everything is so messed up, he does take the law into his own hands, but he's still turning them over to the police.
Okay.
And so it's different. And it's, again, it's why characters like Daredevil I really do like, because they do recognize the problem.
Sure, sure.
But they're still trying to uphold the system at the end of the day. So, and that's different than some of the other things that we've seen. But let's take this a step and go, did you read anything into the non-traumatized Bruce Wayne having a beard?
I have a couple thoughts about that. I would imagine that if you're wearing the cowl, you have to shave, right? Like, you can't put that on. Speaking from experience, I would imagine that you have to shave. I mean, this is why Jim Gordon shaves, right? Because he has to ultimately put on this the cape and cowl. But I think there could be more to it in terms of Bruce Wayne adopting this identity where he just happens to wear a beard. I don't want to read too much into it, but there is this sense of freedom. And you know, I have to say, when I've worked with some military service members and veterans, some of their experiences are like that, where they will say, I just want to kind of not let myself go, but just experience the freedom of not having to shave, experience the freedom of wearing civilian clothing. And they kind of, these small steps and these what for us are minor luxuries are really appreciated and experienced as emblems of being reintegrated. And so I wonder if this, maybe he didn't realize it, but this could be a symbol of his reintegration.
We've talked about Gordon's motivation to become Batman to a degree. How would you describe his growth with being the Batman?
That's a great question. I think that there's certainly, from the beginning, there's certainly this sense of duty. There's this sense of role assertion that, and Bruce Wayne, when he was Batman, did this a lot too. Like, no one else can do this. You know, the other Bat family members would step in and say like, Robin, Batgirl, other folks would say, I think I have this, I can do this. And usually his response is, I am the only one who can do this. And we see Jim Gordon actually say that a few times in assertion that he is the right person for this role and knowingly will go into a risky situation and perhaps a life-threatening situation to prove his point. And I think I don't know that there's a ton of growth, but I did notice this sense of this willingness to die. And I think that he may have had these elements before, but the truth is there's this golden thread, which is this loyalty to the law, which we've known for decades that this man has, right? Like, that has not changed. Jim Gordon will die for the law, for what's right, for justice, right? So I think that this is this transformation and a new way of doing that. And that hasn't changed. That is a true sort of Jim Gordon-esque thing. So I'm almost saying in a way that being the Batman has enhanced Jim Gordon and propelled him further into his values. I don't think that he's been violated, or I don't think he's been changed much above and beyond that.
What you described with Jim being, you know, the embodiment of upholding the system and believing in the system and being a good cop is part of the reason why I'm not enjoying Gotham.
Oh, the television show.
Yeah. In season two, they have him doing things that I don't think Jim Gordon would ever have done.
I have to admit, I have not watched episodes of season two, but what are you seeing that you think is just not him?
Collaborating with the Penguin, killing a guy.
Oh my.
Covering it up, assisting the Penguin in kidnapping the elected mayor and letting Penguin kill him. So very un-Jim Gordon things. And if they're trying to make the point that Gotham gets you dirty, that's fine. But I feel that they've broken the character by taking it too far.
Yeah.
And that's something that has bothered me, because Gordon wouldn't do that.
Right. Right.
He's the one who keeps the light on. He's the one who believes in the system. He's the one who, when Bruce Wayne finally grows up and becomes Batman, you know, he's able to do his job better because there's somebody else out there. And I feel the show's violated that.
That's a huge problem. I had some other issues with it in the first season, just it not quite fitting with multiple characters and other issues. So it's interesting that they seem to be continuing with that, with those violations, I would say. That's unfortunate.
You know, the comic book shows that do well are the ones that stay true to the source material.
Right.
And so, like, The Flash, they're doing a wonderful job with that, and it's not afraid to have fun. And there are other examples, you know, we can be at Daredevil or Jessica Jones or Arrow, you know, like, there are a bunch that embrace the comic book source material. I feel Gotham has deviated from what makes Jim Gordon Jim Gordon, where I preferred Scott Snyder's Jim Gordon, and being that, not man on the wall, but he stands the long watch.
Right, right.
So how would you compare Gordon's motivation to be the Batman to Bruce Wayne's motivation to be the Batman?
Well, I think we have this, like we were saying before, there is this history that Bruce has. And I'm saying Bruce versus Bruce Wayne. I tend to kind of make the distinction, because when I say Bruce Wayne, I think of the social exterior, the character that he assumes to be in the public eye. So Bruce has experienced, as we've discussed before, a tragic childhood trauma that I would probably say is one of the most horrific things that you can experience as a child. There are multiple things. I'm sure we can come up with multiple things, but probably one of the most detrimental psychologically in terms of childhood trauma. And essentially, the difference between his motivation and Jim Gordon's motivation is the personalized aspect of it. I think that Jim Gordon is valuing the community and valuing the law and believing strongly in his profession. But when he goes home at the end of the day, he has his family and he's incredibly connected to and values and finds his meaning from his family. Throughout the decades, things have changed here and there, but that has kind of been how we've characterized him. And Bruce has actually opposed building too strong of connections to family. He has been somewhat, I mean, it depends on the version. Some will say standoffish, some will say a bit guarded, and some will say downright antisocial when it comes to connections to other people. And all of that is said, from my perspective, as something that is, for him, a protective barrier, and for him, his source of resiliency, and for him, his motivation in life. That for him, it's beyond the profession. This bat character has basically consumed him in all dimensions. And that looks very different for him than it would look for Jim.
Which brings us to what I think is some of Scott Snyder's best work, because in issue 48, we have Bloom do a massive monologue holding Gordon in his fist. And I want to get your thoughts on Bloom's quote. "See, this Batman, their Batman, he's not what the real Batman was about. The real Batman was about doing it for himself. He was about taking power into his own hands. He was a wildflower, a weed, like me, like you." What are your, is Bloom right? Or do you have a different view on that?
I think there's an element of truth to that. And it's intended to be that way, because knowing the way Scott writes, we should all read that and feel gutted. Like, yeah, there's an element of honesty that for all of us, we are motivated by this personal and sometimes revengeful side of us, and that we're all just trying to claw out of it and find meaning. And so I think that's intentional. I think that we are supposed to understand that very well and to see it as not an accusation or something that's fleeting. I think we're supposed to be riveted by this. And it's supposed to be a direct challenge to Jim, of course, who has a broader belief in what he's doing. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that it's 100% true. I think that this is the darkness that we fall into. And this is the darkness that Bruce Wayne falls into, or Bruce falls into, when he struggles with his identity as Batman. And it's interesting that comes up, that narrative comes up, because that is leading to this notion of Bruce Wayne becoming Batman again and realizing, you know, being propelled into this direction, whether he likes it or not, his encounter with who could be the Joker on a park bench, Robin telling him he's missing the signs and he is missing his true calling. Even his encounter with Alfred, which is painful for us to read through, but we understand that it must be done. You know, that's essentially what's happening there. This is his call to action. And so there's this, I think, important moment there where we're understanding that he must return to this. He must return to this role. And what will he, you know, how will he do it? What will he make from it? Will he be this tragic character that we continue to worry about? Because that's why we read Batman. I mean, it goes down to like why I love reading about Batman and why this character is fascinating to me, is that he is flawed and he's experiencing tremendous tragedy on an ongoing basis. And that element is something that we're curious about because we experience the same thing. And there was an interview that Scott did, I believe it was around the beginning of this arc, where he made it very clear that the purpose of this tragedy, the purpose of having Bruce struggle, is for us to understand the meaning of trauma, and for us to understand that he makes meaning of that, and we have to do the same thing. It's that idea of the Joker being chaotic and being, all about randomness, this idea that terrible things are going to happen to just anybody. And in my field, that's true. That's actually what we say over and over again around the idea that, like, there's nothing we could have done in most cases to have prevented these horrific things that happen to us. And so we live with that guilt and we live with that pain. And the Joker represents that idea that the randomness of life and the horrific trauma in life is his joke. I mean, that's what he creates laughter around. That's how he manipulates and horrifies us. And so we have to look to Batman to understand, how do we make meaning from these random horrific things and learn recovery and resiliency?
If the guy on the park bench was the Joker, I find it highly appropriate he was a butcher.
Oh, yes. That was such an interesting scene.
Very interesting discussion, getting out the gun, what that represented. But Bruce choosing to become Batman again, I reject Bloom's argument, because no sane person who's happy and content goes, you're right, I'm doing this for me. I'm going to wipe out my personality, wipe up my memories, impose a trauma on myself so I can go fight for the sake of others, because I'm doing it for me.
I certainly think that there is a bigger motivation. There's something beyond, you know, the individual need. But what I meant by agreeing with Bloom is that sense of accuracy sometimes, where we do make decisions because of the pain we're in. We do make decisions because of regret, guilt, revenge, and that has absolutely 100% to do with the individual need, the selfish need, right?
Yes. What did you make of the dream sequence where Bruce Wayne sees himself as the mayor of Gotham, working within the system, being the leader?
I didn't quite understand what it is we were seeing, other than these were perhaps, of course, these were manifestations of his own nightmares, wishes, dreams, whatever you want to say. These were coming out of his brain, his mind. And so my thoughts were, these are sort of alternate realities coming from his, you know, the fragments of his brain. And maybe somewhere in there is this hope that he could operate like that. How did you see that?
You really are a doctor. What did it mean to you?
How did you feel?
I felt here was somebody who wanted to work within the system, who wanted to be the leader, who wanted to be in the light, that the Bruce Wayne who grew up without the trauma would have been the mayor of Gotham, would have been the hero who operated in daylight, who cleaned up the corruption by being that type of hero, as opposed to the one in the mask. And when we see him, you know, that mental version of himself wearing a white outfit, fighting in daylight, it's different. It's a completely different type of hero. And so I liked it. Because again, I'm kind of in that law and order camp.
Of course, you did.
Yeah, I want the Constitution upheld. You know, that's the world I want to be in.
It was disturbing to me. I did not want that world.
It's, you know what? I'm sure the others can do great psychological profiles of each of us on how we react to that. So, but. Again, it's part of the reason why I like Green Lantern, because at the end of the day, he's a cop.
Yeah.
Who's supposed to not kill people, which gets into Sinestro War and all that good stuff. But that's another time. So let's talk about sacrifice, because in order for Bruce Wayne to become the Batman again, he has to basically have his mind wiped past the point of brain death to have the trauma be re-uploaded into his mind to be the original Bruce Wayne again. And Alfred doesn't want to pull the switch. Bruce is willing to go through the process, but it's Julie who throws the switch. Who made the greater sacrifice? Julie for killing the man that she loved, or Bruce for putting himself on the chopping block?
This is like one of those trolley ethical questions, isn't it? Trying to push me into the ethical corner of making this decision. I think they're different types of sacrifices. I think that although I didn't quite connect with Julie, like I didn't have enough, you know, this is not a very long arc, so I didn't have enough time to get to know her in this story. I understood that as finishing what she felt her father had started. And so her father being somebody who apparently sold the weapon to Joe Chill, who murdered Bruce Wayne's parents. So that's the link there. I think that she understood what it would mean that after this process, she would no longer be able to have a life with him, that he would forget her entirely. And even if he did meet her, there wouldn't be a connection there, that he wouldn't choose her over the Batman lifestyle. So I think she knew exactly what that meant. And I think, of course, that's a huge sacrifice. That's her future. I don't know that I was as moved. I think certainly probably what was going on with me is that I was focused in on Alfred during this entire re-traumatization of Batman or of Bruce Wayne. And I understood that Bruce Wayne could handle it. So that aspect where he's essentially being psychologically and physically tortured during this process, I got the sense that he was resilient enough to withstand it, because throughout the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 issues, they've been basically telling us that he is the only person who could withstand this. So I wasn't necessarily concerned with him.
Very valid points. And I have mixed feelings on it. And I'll spend a little time thinking, did Julie commit murder, or is this just non-FDA approved medical procedures at this point? But we do have informed consent. It gets really weird and complicated super quickly on that. So
you just needed a whole episode on this re-traumatization machine that apparently has this like secret code, this Alfred code.
Yeah, and the dark plan to, I'll just keep making clones of myself so that, and uploading my brain to them, so that way there will always be a Batman. It's like, that's different.
What did you make, so my last question for you would be, what did you make of the experiences in this machine being these novel, otherworldly type things versus actual things that Batman has gone through, like almost losing, actually losing Jason, losing Damian, almost losing Dick Grayson a gazillion times, almost losing Barbara Gordon? Why not just create what he had gone, like, why are these weird other universe type things happening in this machine?
That's a good question. Part of it might be the secret Walter Mitty life of Bruce Wayne. Part of it is it's the all the trauma that he's gone through. When you lose sidekicks, you know, when you dress boys as targets, you're just asking for trouble.
Oh, that's rough. I don't. Wow, that's.
It's reason why Stan Lee killed Bucky. He didn't like having the kid sidekick, and. You know, we've lost 2, 3. You know, there were years when I wasn't reading, but, you know, I remember Death in the Family. I didn't call in, but we were reading it. We were getting it and rushing to the comic book store.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jason Todd's death was extremely important, because after Todd died, Batman was very brutal after that. And it took Nightwing visiting and, you know, to help him get past that and realize also Batman needs a Robin.
Right, right.
So to balance it. So there could be a few things at play there, but I think it's all the experiences that make Batman Batman. Also, he probably doesn't want to repeat some mistakes. Knowing why you have, you know, an empty Robin uniform on display is pivotal to understanding him.
Yeah.
So that would be my interpretation, but there could be others. And there are those who have like read every issue for the last 75 years. So there's probably others way more knowledgeable than I. But we will see. I'm looking forward to 50.
Me too. I really would like to see how this is going to start up again, for sure.
I think Bloom is a super creepy character, because the way people mutate from the seeds getting into their blood is disturbing. What he did to Gordon, I don't know if Gordon's going to survive or not, or if he'll take up the cowl again. Don't know where they'll go with that. But part of me always feels a little cheated when you kill off a hero and you have somebody else take up the mantle. I think it belittles them when, you know, the original hero comes back. However, in the comic book world, you will never kill off somebody who's going to be in movies. You know, it's like, it's a little convenient that issue 50 should coincide with Batman versus Superman.
Sure.
Just as Steve Rogers will be Captain America again around the time, shortly after the time Civil War comes out. So the comic book companies will always do that because it's business.
Right.
And also we want to see their heroes come back. I don't know. You're the doctor. You can make whatever psychological analysis you want of me, but I'm okay with moving forward and seeing somebody else take up the gauntlet, because then it's their journey, and I feel it belittles their journey when it just gets like wiped out.
Yeah, I'm open to that. I agree. There should be multiple stories, multiple narratives, and not just one way to represent this really important superhero. And so who knows? I mean, I think, again, to go back to what Scott has said, the question isn't necessarily whether they come back, but how they come back. What do they do to overcome? What do they do to rise up? And what lessons have they learned? And it's iterative. So I appreciate that storytelling. I'm okay with the same characters coming back, but I do have issue with mind wipes and memory implants and all sorts of things. This is happening with Batgirl right now, where there's this history of memory implants. And so it changes the real psychology of the lessons learned from those adversities and traumatic experiences. And so it makes my job harder when, you know, someone is just saying like, well, that was just a chip in their brain.
Yeah. We'll just hit the reset button.
Right, right.
And now everything's hunky-dory. You know, no, there are times when that's okay, because while Superior Iron Man was amazing, Tony Stark being a raging schmuck was painful to read after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so after Secret Wars, the fact that we have good Tony back actually feels refreshing. And yeah. And the current comic is wicked fun. So they're doing lots of good stuff in there. If you're not reading that, I highly recommend it. But other times, when somebody else takes up the mantle and you go through the entire arc of what it means to be Batman or Captain America, which both Marvel and DC have now done twice, you know, former sidekicks or other supporting cast members taking up the mantle of those heroes, and then kind of wiping them clean, that's always bothered me.
Yeah.
But I get why. You know, in comics, it's okay that death is not permanent.
Right.
Because not everyone gets to be Uncle Ben. So, but with that, how can people follow you on Twitter and follow your podcasts?
So the best way to interact with me is on Twitter, at Arkham Asylum Doc is my Twitter name. I have a website, underthemaskonline.com, where you can find some of my writings about the psychology of superheroes. I have a TED Talk about the psychology of superheroes and the power of the superhero narrative. And I have a podcast called The Arkham Sessions, and you can also find that on the website.
And did you hang up the sketch art that we had done of you at Comic Fest?
Yes. Thank you so much for the lovely sketch, which actually I'm going to post on social media with your approval.
Let me check my notes from the artist, but yes. Okay.
I always want to check just in case, but I would love to share with folks how just how great it was. And when I saw it, I immediately felt that it captured the experience of being participating in the mock trial of the Winter Soldier.
You worked so hard for that, because both you and Janina Scarlett, you both did super detailed, thoughtful expert witness reports. And it's funny how we got the idea for the artist. Here's how the origin story of the sketch artist. I went to go get a glass of wine before calling it a day, and talking with the bartender and telling him about the trial, he asked, "Hey, do you have a courtroom artist?" And I went, "No, but there's going to be a room full of them." So I shot Wendy a note, one of the organizers, and she recruited Eric, to play courtroom artist. So that was perhaps the only time you had an Eisner Award-winning artist.
Oh my gosh. So he was there during the trial?
Yes, sketching during testimony.
And then amazing.
And then he spent the rest of the day and a chunk of Sunday finishing those sketches of everyone.
That is fantastic. Thank you so much for arranging that. And yes, I appreciate it. It's a really nice, just a nice thing to have after what was a very educational and very just a good time with the legal students and the psychologists and the judge. It was a really great experience.
I'm glad you enjoyed it just as much as I have enjoyed having you as a guest on our podcast.
Thank you, Josh.
My pleasure. And so that, everyone, stay geeky. Stay geeky, America.